I wasn't born to go with the flow. I was born to make a difference, to make waves. I want my sweat and hard work to mean something. I was born to serve in the United States Coast Guard. If you were born ready to lead, to protect, to uphold the law, then visit GoCoastGuard.com. The United States Coast Guard. Born ready.
Sponsored by the United States Coast Guard. In cooperation with the Maryland, D.C., Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
Newsmakers on the Dorbeck Insider.
Tom Trabucco, Director of External Affairs at the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board.
Somebody noticed a change in their account balance that didn't reflect contributions or earnings. So what we did is activated our core at the call centers to give them information for any of these folks to tell them of our plan to get this right. We'll notify all affected participants, offer to take the funds back, reverse the transaction, and make them whole.
Hear the entire interview online. FederalNewsRadio.com/DorbeckInsider.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this fine Monday, January 17th, 2011. First, to honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., his accomplishments, and his birthday. So I hope we have a larger audience because of that, and certainly we're archived. And to honor him, I don't know if this is an honor, we're going to talk about income taxes, and we have Ed Zerndorfer. Ed has got more initials next to his name, but I'll do the really powerful ones. And an enrolled agent, and somebody might say, what's that? And that's very hard to get. Certified financial planner, moderator of something called Federal Soup, and Ed will explain how that works, and it's a really nifty tool for people to go online and talk about questions, benefits, and Ed answers questions and benefits. Ed's a nice guy as well, retired Fed, and fellow seminar presenter, author of articles in FEN, Federal Employees News Digest. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we do this every year at least once, especially this time of year, and I always kind of look forward to it because you've forgotten more about taxes than I know. So we're going to go through some things, and for those of you listening, we're at 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. Now, again, remember today is January 17th. And it is about 10:08. We will go off the air about 10:58. If you're listening at another time, don't call that number. We'll give you an email address later. Ed, I think probably the first thing, if you don't mind, if we talked about why some people can't file their tax returns as they might want to until middle to late February. Why?
Well, Bob, Congress was a little bit late passing this year's tax bill. As you recall, they finally passed the tax bill about a day or two before Christmas, before the Christmas break. And as a result, it's going to take IRS a little bit longer than normal to get their computers up and running in anticipation of people filing their 2010 income taxes. So IRS is recommending for people in particular who itemize, they should not file their taxes until at least the middle to late February to make sure that their returns can be processed. It's as simple as that. Now, people have simpler returns. For example, they do not itemize. They may file a Form 1040 EZ. They just have wages to report. They can file their taxes as early as, I believe, now, because the IRS is now open for business regarding for accepting people's tax returns.
Yeah, and the people would say, well, why not? Didn't IRS know? Well, IRS didn't know whether they were going to expand or the Bush tax cuts, if you will. They didn't know if new rates would come in. So, and you and I, and our colleagues had a hard time talking about taxes in 2011 for much of 2010 because you really didn't know what might be extended. And we'll talk about what extending means later. And we didn't really know about tax rates. But we tried to cover the bases as best we could. Congress, like you said, made up their minds late in the year. And, of course, you have to program computers to handle a gazillion tax returns. So you don't want those computers backed up. So with that in mind, let's take a look at one of the things that really doesn't have a lot to do with preparing your tax return, but it's got a lot of economic power. There was a cut in Social Security tax taken out of one's salary. And it's important to remember that, out of one's salary. And it's not for employers, but if we're working and we receive a W-2, our Social Security, not the Medicare, but Social Security rate dropped from what to what?
It dropped from 6.2% of one's wages down to 4.2%.
So you're saying it's almost like a 2% raise.
That's correct, Bob.
Tax-free.
It's a tax cut of 2% for most federal employees. Now, let's keep in mind then that not all federal employees pay into Social Security. Those employees who are covered by the Civil Service Retirement System, known as CSRS, do not pay into Social Security. They will not be receiving a 2% payroll tax cut. However, those employees who are covered by the newer retirement system, the Federal Employees Retirement System, or FERS, and those employees who are covered by something called CSRS offset, both these employees do pay into Social Security, and they will be receiving that 2% payroll tax cut for calendar year 2011. I want to emphasize it's only for calendar year 2011 because the tax rate, the so-called FICA tax, Federal Insurance Contribution Act tax rate, will go from 4.2% back to 6.2% starting with the first pay date in January 2012.
So those listening, although a sensitive subject, did not receive a COLA this year. But nonetheless, their bring-home check, mirror image of 2010, would go up 2%. So if somebody's compensation, say, and you can multiply this by whatever you want to get at your own number, is $50,000, it would be $1,000 tax-free coming to you for not only this year, 2011, but 2012 as well.
Not for 2012.
No.
No, it's only going to be for calendar year 2011.
Okay.
The way Congress wrote the law.
All righty. Then, if that's the case, what are you telling people to do with the 2%?
Well, what I'm explaining to when I'm in class and I'm doing a tax planning seminar is that with your 2% tax cut, payroll tax cut, call it a 2% pay increase, if you will, why don't you turn around and put it into your thrift savings plan? If you're not maximizing your thrift savings plan contribution, and we just want to go over what the maximum is for 2011, it's $16,500 regular contributions. And for employees age 50 and over by the end of this year, they can put an additional $5,500 catch-up contribution. So that makes a total of $22,000. If they did not maximize their TSP in 2010, they should make every intention to put more money into the TSP for 2011 and use the 2% payroll tax cut.
So it sounds like the max in 2011 was the same max as in 2010.
That's correct. It has not changed.
But in this case, we'd be able to get a tax deduction basically for free and money into a tax-deferred investment.
That's correct. And for those employees who are not who have maximized their TSP, what can they do with the 2% wage increase, if you will? They can turn around and put money into an IRA. We're going to talk about IRAs, I assume, later on.
Right.
But there's still time, for example, to put money into an IRA for 2010. So they could use their tax cut now to fund their IRAs for the year 2010.
And if they did have debt, they could pay down debt. That's a nice return on one's investment. I don't know what the lowest interest rate on a credit card can be, but I certainly know what the highest can be.
That's correct. That's correct. That's a good suggestion. Pay down your debt.
Okay, so we've got issues with filing the tax returns for those that itemize, but not for those that don't itemize. And we talked about the cut in Social Security taxes. And I believe there was another provision extended. Now, when we say extended, there were a number of benefits that were in the tax law under the proverbial Bush tax cuts. Now, let's just call them there were a number of issues, and they were to expire at the end of 2010. And Congress passed some of these for a year, some of these for two, and one of these are for individuals that live in states that don't have an income tax, Florida, Nevada, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Washington State, and Wyoming, that they could still claim instead of a state income tax, because they don't have one, although Tennessee's got a teeny one, they could claim sales tax. Now, is that right? Sales tax on anything?
It's sales tax on any items you pay. Most people who buy cars or buy the furniture, they pay sales tax in the state of in which they live in. Note that these states that you mentioned, Bob, Florida, Nevada, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Washington, Wyoming, do not have state income taxes, but they have state sales taxes. There are two states that have neither income taxes nor sales taxes, and those two states are New Hampshire and Alaska, so they would not benefit from this. For many, many years, residents of states that did not have state income taxes but had state sales taxes were complaining that they, in fact, have to pay more in federal taxes because they cannot deduct their sales taxes. So the law was changed back in 2004, allowing these residents to have the option, in general, allowing individual taxpayers the choice of deducting sales taxes or income taxes on their federal returns, taxes that they pay to their states. You would think that somebody who lives in a state that has a state income tax would always be they will always be using their state income tax as a deduction on the federal return. Not the case for some people. People who buy big ticket items like cars, boats, may end up paying more sales tax to their state in a given year compared to paying the state income, the amount of state income taxes they paid in that year. If in a given year that's the case, you could have the choice of deducting either the sales tax or the state income tax. You can't do both, though.
Oh, darn it. All right, there was another extension, and I'm sure you had these discussions as well as most people in the tax prep industry about energy-efficient tax credits. Let's talk about what a credit is in a second. But the law was to expire at the end of 2010, and you saw it in the media, you saw it in the advertising, you have to get this done before 2010. Well, it was extended to 2011, although not quite as robust as what it was. So what's the story with that? How much can somebody now claim in 2011 that maybe missed a target in 2010?
There is a tax credit up to 10% of what they pay for an individual homeowner installs things like insulation or energy-efficient windows or roofs. The credits range from anywhere from $50 to $150, also for purchases of energy-efficient fans, water heaters, and furnaces. Now, the 10% tax credit and the $50 to $150 tax credit is not as generous as it was back in 2009 and 2010, but nonetheless, it is there. I think individuals should look beyond taxes, though, as far as installing these energy-efficient items, because they'll save on money in terms of what they're paying for home heating costs and home cooling costs in a given year. So that's another reason people should look into buying these energy-efficient items.
Now, is a tax credit something that you get recognized in the paper for making your home more efficient, or does it go back in your pocket? And what's the difference between a credit and a deduction?
A tax deduction reduces the amount of your taxable income that is subject to tax. A tax credit, on the other hand, reduces one's tax liability dollar for dollar. So a tax credit is more valuable. Example, suppose you have a $100 tax deduction, and you, let's say, are in a very simple 25% tax marginal tax bracket. By having a $100 tax deduction, it saves you 25% of $100 or $25 in federal taxes. We're talking federal taxes here. On the other hand, if you had a $100 tax credit, that $100 tax credit will reduce your liability by $100. So the difference here between the two is
huge.
You're talking a difference of $75 in tax savings. That's the bottom line. So a tax credit is always more valuable than a tax deduction.
Yeah. Okay, good. And we'll probably talk about credits, I'm sure, as we go through all these different things. There were many tax laws passed in 2010. These were more the extenders. The other tax laws that were passed had some benefit to individual taxpayers, but they were more employers and businesses, if you will. And we're trying to stay on the individual side of life here. Another thing that was extended, there was mortgage insurance. If you paid it, back when I was buying, you know, my first houses, I had to have mortgage insurance, but I never got a deduction for it. But later on in life, there is a mortgage insurance deduction that banks would require the individual pay if they didn't put a certain amount of money down on the home. But that was a tax deduction, but it was scheduled to be phased out in 2010. But it's been given life, hasn't it, with this last-minute change in the law?
Yes, for the year 2011, as was true during 2010, those homeowners who pay mortgage insurance, and again, who pays mortgage insurance, if one put down less than 20% as a down payment on their house, then they have to, the mortgage company requires them to pay mortgage insurance. They are able to deduct the mortgage insurance as an itemized deduction on Schedule A. Again, we're talking about individuals here who itemize. If you do not itemize for some reason, you cannot take advantage of the mortgage insurance deduction.
So we have a pretty broad base of individuals listening to the show, beginning career on through almost pre-retirement, and retirees as well. So this is probably going to be more beamed at the beginning career, maybe mid-career, the pre-retirees, the mortgages are generally paid down. But maybe somebody listening that isn't in this category knows somebody that is and just was say, are you aware that you can claim this on your return? And might be of benefit to the individual listening.
There were probably a lot of people, Bob, during 2010 who refinanced for one reason or another. Maybe they had to, and they couldn't come up with the required down payment. As a result, they're going to pay mortgage insurance. A lot of things happened in the mortgage industry in 2010, as you know, Bob. So individuals have to, they'll know if they paid the mortgage insurance, and if so, they really should consider this when they're preparing their 2010 income taxes.
All righty. Let's go back to credit again now. A credit, as Ed was saying, is a dollar-for-dollar reduction of your taxes, not subject to whatever tax bracket you might be in. And it was something called a child tax credit. And it was around, and again, it was to cease its existence at December 31st, 2010. But it's been given, what, at least another year, or is it two? I don't know.
Not sure if it was extended through 2012, but definitely was extended for 2011.
Now, this is serious money. This is, not that the energy credit is anything to sneeze at, but it's, like you say, it's not as robust as it was. But this is $1,000.
Yes, the child credit allows eligible families to use a tax credit of up to $1,000 for each qualifying child that lives in their household. The child has to be under the age of 17, though. When the child reaches 17, they are not eligible for this tax credit. Or I should say the parents are not.
Okay, and that child at 17 or older, it would be immaterial whether they were students or not.
That's correct. That's right. Correct. They live in the household.
Okay, so if you prepare your own return, make sure you've got this on it. If you have your own return prepared, make sure it's on it.
Well, I just want to mention to you, Bob, in class many times I get the question, well, I take the child tax credit. What are you talking about here? I said, well, this is a credit for the fact that you've raised that child during the year and lives in your household. Well, I take the credit because my child gets dependent care. I take the dependent care tax credit. That's a different credit, Bob. There's the child tax credit, and there's the child and dependent care tax credit. Those are two different credits.
So you can add them together, too.
You can add them. You're eligible for both.
And just to make it more confusing, this should not be confusing, though, you can claim an exemption for a child on your return. Now, that's a tax deduction, as Ed talked about before. That's relative to one's tax bracket, but it's almost like three bars on a slot machine. We've got a dependent deduction, and we got a child care credit, and we have a child credit.
I mean, there's a lot of potential savings there, Bob.
Yeah, and again, for those of you preparing your own returns, please be aware of that. And if you have your return prepared, just make sure that it's there. I'm reasonably certain that it would be if it is prepared by a professional. All righty, there are some other credits that were extended for higher education purposes. And to be fair, there's a lady at the office, I always say, now, is that the opportunity credit or is that the whatever? Ed, can you make any sense out of these two things?
There is the American Opportunity Credit, which was passed last year, but now is extended through 2012. And this credit provides a tax credit of up to $2,500 per college student per year. This credit is in addition to the lifetime learning tax credit. That's available for, also available to eligible individuals, parents who have children in college. So we have two potential tax credits there, but I want to emphasize that both the American Opportunity Tax Credit and the Lifetime Learning Tax Credit are subject to adjusted gross income limitations. We didn't mention this with the child tax credit, but you know, many of the good things out there, Bob, credits and deductions are subject to AGI, adjusted gross income limitations. And if your AGI is over a certain amount, you can't take advantage of these limitations.
What's AGI?
AGI, bottom line, is it's your total income minus some adjustments. But for most individuals, it is the number that shows up on the bottom of page one of Form 1040 or 1040A. It shows up on the bottom of the page.
Okay, so this is kind of the number before you flip the page over and you claim your itemized deductions for mortgage interest,
and
real
personal
estate
exemptions and things
et cetera.
Like that.
So it's kind of and for most people listening, it's probably the total income on the return. Some people might claim adjustments, many don't.
That's right.
And people say, well, what's the difference between this and gross income and adjusted gross income? My head's spinning here, and taxable income. I think Ed's viewpoint is the best. Look at your tax return, first page, bottom right-hand number. That's your adjusted gross income number.
That's what I always recommend. Just look on the bottom of the Form 1040 or 1040A, page one.
All righty. Let's say that an individual was preparing the return, and they didn't really have any taxable income for whatever reason, and they spent money for higher education expenses. Could they still get money back?
Isn't it
a refundable credit? If you didn't have any taxes and you were entitled to this, I think they'll send you a $1,000 check.
I believe it's 40% of the credit is refundable. We really need to define what refundable is. There are non-refundable and refundable tax credits. A non-refundable tax credit means that if your tax liability is zero, and you're eligible for some tax credits, like the child tax credit, you cannot, the IRS will not allow you to take that credit. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there is a refundable tax credit. What that means is even if your income, your taxable income is zero, you are allowed to take that the credit, and the IRS will actually send you money for as a result of that credit being refundable. Two examples come to mind. The earned income tax is a tax credit, is a refundable tax credit. The American Opportunity Tax Credit, up to 40% of it is refundable as a tax credit, up to 40%. So what that means is, since the maximum credit is $2,500, 40% of $2,500 is $1,000. So up to $1,000 of that credit is refundable. But, Bob, I'll be honest with you. I have a feeling that anybody who has children in college is going to have taxable income, and I don't think they have to worry about the credit being refundable.
Okay. All righty. IRAs come in different flavors. There's a Roth IRA, there's a traditional IRA, and then there's this other thing called a Coverdell Education Savings Account, which is kind of sort of like an IRA, isn't it? Kind of, sort of, but not exactly.
It sort of is, but not exactly. They used to call the Coverdell Educational Savings Account, they used to call them educational IRAs. The late Senator Paul Coverdell, Florida, who designed this thing, they changed the name in honor of, in his memory. And what it is an individual can put up to $2,000 into this so-called educational IRA. The money that goes in is after-tax dollars, but any earnings you receive will grow tax-free, provided when you pull the money out of it, it is used to pay for some type of educational expenses. It does not have to be for higher education. You could pull the money out to pay for nursery school tuition, for parochial school, private school tuition, things like that. It doesn't have to be used for higher education. It was the maximum contribution for 2010 was $2,000 a year. It used to be $500 a year, I think, before the Bush tax cuts came in. But the they were going to bring it back down to $500 maximum contribution. But with the tax law passage, it's going to be extended to $2,000 a year. And also, before they passed the 2010 tax law, Congress wanted to make it that you only could use the money to pay for higher education, post-college. So I know back in the fall, I was recommending to clients that they take the money out of there if they don't have any children in college, spend the money now before Congress changes the law. Well, Congress did change the law, so now you still can use the money, pull the money out of it, of a Coverdale educational savings account tax-free to pay for any type of education.
Now, I don't mean to put you on the spot with this one, but I never quite get it straight with my own head. If somebody had one of these, and they had the proverbial 529, the prepaid tuition plan, the college education plan, as I understand it, the college education plan, the prepaid tuition plan, would not cover things like computers. So if you wanted to buy a computer, then you would need one of these. How do you pronounce it again?
It's called a Coverdale Educational Savings Account.
Yeah, and that could be used to pay for the computers.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did that last year. Our younger daughter needed a computer, and I had set up an educational IRA back when she was 10 years old. The money had grown from $500 to $1,000. I pulled it out and bought her a nice laptop computer for college.
Okay.
So these things do work.
And I know your wife was a participant in that as well, so it's nice to have nice mom and dad. Anyway, Ed, I'm lucky because I can call you up and we can sit here and I can ask you questions. But for those of you that aren't sitting in here or can't call Ed up, how can one address not only you but this federal soup thing? Could you tell me a little bit about federal soup?
Well, let me just mention, Bob, that I am a columnist for the Federal Employees News Digest. I write a column every week called the Informed Investor Column, in which I write columns not only on taxes, but I write columns. I talk about benefits for federal employee benefits. I write columns on I write quite a few columns on the Thrift Savings Plan, insurance issues. The website for the Federal Employees News Digest is www.federaldaily, one word, federaldaily.com. If you want to subscribe to the Federal Employees News Digest, Federal Employees News Digest has an online forum called Federal Soup. It's one word, Federal Soup. And part of the online forum is devoted to questions and answers. And I run that particular part of the forum. If you have any questions about your federal employee benefits, taxes, insurance, TSP, you can send your question to the website www.federalsoup, one word, federal soup, soup like soup, S-O-U-P, .com, and direct your question under pay and benefits to the Q&A section, and you can send your question to me. There's no limit as far as how many questions one can send, and there is no charge for this. This is absolutely free. I've been doing the Federal Soup Q&A thing now for almost 10 years. Federal Soup started on September 10th, 2001, the day before 9/11, and they've actually archived all the questions out there. So maybe your questions already been asked.
Archived all those questions?
All the questions are out there. So you can do a Google search on the web on that Q&A section, see if your question has already been asked. If it has, read it. The answer is there. But in case your question has not been asked, feel free to send me a question at any time.
And now, what's that website again?
www.federalsoup.com.
Great. Thanks, Ed. All right, let's go back to deductions that were given another breath of fresh air, whether it was 1 or 2 years. One was student loan interest deduction. How's that? I mean, if somebody borrows money to pay for their tuition, they would most likely incur interest. But they can deduct this?
that, yes, they can deduct up to $2,500 in interest paid on student loans. And this extension, because they were going to lower the $2,500, Congress, but the $2,500 limit was extended through December 31st, 2012. There are AGI limitations on this. Now, who would this benefit? If there's a new federal employee out there, fresh out of college, has lots of student loans, they can deduct the interest. I say that because I get this question in class all the time from employees. Says, oh, my son or daughter is in college now. They're paying, they're starting to pay back their loans and so on. So they ask, well, that's great. I therefore can deduct the interest. No, you can't, because they have to deduct the interest. If it's the person who deduct the interest has to claim him or herself on the tax return. If you claim your child as a deduction, you cannot deduct the interest that the child's paying for the student loan. Even if you're paying the interest, if you're claiming the child has to file his or her own tax return and claim him or herself as a personal exemption in order for the child to deduct the interest.
Now, of course, as you mentioned, this AGI thing again, for those of you that weren't listening a few minutes ago, that's page one of your 1040 bottom right-hand number. Let's just make it simple. And so if that amount goes above a certain level, there would be no deduction. So this would probably be best for somebody somewhat recently graduated.
Somebody recently graduated from college, started working for the federal government, or private industry for that matter, and they're paying back student loans.
Okay. All righty. Now, somebody that might enjoy what's called a capital gain. Maybe they have a mutual fund. Maybe they invest some in the market. And a capital gain would be the gain from the sale of an asset. Now, there are also capital losses. Certainly none of your clients. But but on a capital gain, it would mean that you bought this asset or the asset distributed a capital gain to you. And those are taxed at a lower level. And there was some concern, and there may be some more concern, but not until after 2012, that capital gain rate would be increased. But right now, it enjoys a pretty low level, doesn't it?
It's a flat 15% for individuals who are in a 25% or higher marginal tax bracket. Interesting, those individuals who are in a 10 or a 15% marginal tax bracket, their capital gain tax rates, and we have to be a little careful here, we're talking about long-term capital gain tax rates. When I say long-term, I'm referring to the fact that if an individual has owned a capital asset, which would include a stock, a bond, a mutual fund, they've owned it for at least 1 year, and they were to sell it at a gain, they would pay, if they're in a 25% or higher marginal tax bracket, a flat 15% tax, that's federal tax, and if they are in a 10 or a 15% tax bracket, that would mean the individual pays no tax on the sale of that asset, on the profit. But you got to be careful. Got to be very careful, because a little misleading. People think, well, my income this year, I'm in a 15% tax bracket. Oh, that's wonderful. And I've owned these shares of IBM stock, for example, for many, many years. I bought it at $10. I'm going to sell it at $100, make a huge $90 a share profit. And if I have 1,000 shares, I won't pay any tax on that, $90,000 of gain? Not true, because what the IRS says is that you have to add your $90,000 of income to your other income, and that'll determine what tax bracket you are in, which invariably will put you in a higher 25% or higher tax bracket, which means you will end up paying 15%. Okay. So I really recommend that individuals be very careful before they pull that trigger to sell their assets if they think they're going to save on taxes. Talk to their tax professional.
Okay, you mentioned something. I know you know what you're talking about, but somebody might say, really? And you mentioned that a bond could have a capital gain or a capital loss. Now, how could that ever be that even a U.S. Treasury, for example, as well as any corporate, but let's start with one that's very common. It's guaranteed by the government to be paid back by a certain date, so how could it make or lose money in the interim?
Well, There's an inverse relationship between bond prices and interest rates. Let's say you bought a United States Treasury bond, a 30-year Treasury bond, a couple years ago, when interest rates were a little bit higher than they were now. And you bought a $10,000 bond, but because the interest rate was higher, you end up paying for it $9,900, not the full $10,000. You got $100, you bought it at a discount. Now, let's say 2 years later, 2 or 3 years later, interest rates have come down, the bond prices have gone up, and now that bond in the open market might be selling for $10,300. In other words, somebody who wants to buy the bond that you have would pay more, would pay at a premium. So your bond has actually gone up in value by, what, $400. If you were to sell that bond, you would make a $400 profit. You bought it at $9,900. You're selling at $10,300. You have a $400 capital gain, and that would be subject to either 15% tax tax rate or 0%, depending on what tax bracket you're in.
Okay, so a long story short, you were the smart one that bought the bond years ago. I was not. And I said, Ed, you know, we're buds, aren't we? And you go, well, maybe. What do you want, Bob? And I'd say, I'd like to buy your bond, for face value. And you're going to turn around and say, you know, again, we're buds, but my bond is really worth more, so you're going to have to pay me some more. And it's not that you're, you know, a bad guy. It's just, it's the market value of it. Is that the way it works?
It's the market value. That determines what a fair market value is, will determine what the price will be. And again, the individuals have to keep in mind that while the interest that you get on the bond is taxable as so-called ordinary tax rates, the profit you get by selling it, if you do sell it at a profit, is subject to capital gain tax rates, which are now the so-called preferential rates. Again, assuming you've owned this asset for at least 1 year. 1 year.
Okay. Now, Ed, I have to ask you this, and what we did thus far, we moved pretty quickly, but we weren't way out there. This one is not way out there, but it's baffling to most folks. Alternative minimum tax. I mean, the in class, I would say, well, more often than not, people say, could you explain it? And I said, let me explain it with visuals, because if I try to do it verbally, we'll all be asleep in 15 minutes. Now, what is it in a nutshell, and who should be anxious about it?
In a nutshell, Bob, it is a parallel tax to the regular tax. Congress established the AMT about 40 years ago in order to make sure that individuals who were not paying their taxes, not because they did anything wrong or illegal, it's because they were investing in things that would result in their not paying a certain amount of tax. For example, individuals who buy revenue bonds, state issues a bond, residents of that state buy the bond. The bond is used to build housing, money is used to fix the roads. The interest that are paid on that bond is income tax, the regular income tax free, but it's subject many times to this other tax called the AMT. So you may get around the regular tax, but you're not going to get around the AMT. And there are other items, so-called preference items, that will result in, while the income resulting from these particular items is not subject to regular tax, it will be subject to the AMT. Bottom line is, individuals who think they're going to avoid paying the regular tax may end up paying this AMT, because the AMT calculation, which is a separate calculation from the regular tax calculation, results in a higher tax compared to the regular tax.
Okay, let me make sure let me summarize this in the way I understand it. You mentioned that it's a parallel system. So if one visualized what Ed was talking about as parallel, he's spot on with that. And the first column would be your regular tax, the way we've known it over the years, income minus deductions, taxed it, like Ed said, at a certain rate, and it comes up with a total tax. Now, parallel to that is another column. Let's say to the right, to the left, take whatever way you want to go. And the same number pops up. But to this number, there are things that are not deductible under this column, and some things that are added on. And at the end of the day, you come up with the same thing that Ed mentioned before called taxable income, but the same tax rates aren't used for this. And many of you might remember that one of the huge reasons this tax law was not passed until the end of December was something called the Altman patch. And what the alternative minimum tax really is, while a parallel system, it's akin to a flat tax. But there was a certain amount of income that would be exempted from it, and that was called the patch that would keep many people out of it. And I tell people in class, once you're in the alternative minimum tax, it's like quicksand. It's extremely hard to get out of it.
According, just to follow up what you mentioned there, Bob, there was a study by H&R Block. It stated that if Congress had not put that patch in, up to 25 million taxpayers would have been subject to AMT. And that's an increase from almost $4 million taxpayers in 2009. It would have jumped by, $21 million if had Congress not put that patch in.
So not only did it behoove the taxpayer, it behooved Congress, because getting reelected with that many people being added to the, I don't think people should vote with their tax return, but it's certainly part of it, isn't it?
It's part of it, and I think this is an ongoing thing with Congress. They do this every year. It's not just a one-shot deal. It's an annual thing because, unfortunately, the AMT was designed to catch higher taxpayers in terms of higher income taxpayers from avoiding paying their fair amount of taxes through a legal way. But unfortunately, because Congress has not adjusted, has not made modifications, permanent modifications to the deductions, as you mentioned, to the so-called preference items, the result has been that many middle-class taxpayers are now subject to the AMT. What I recommend to individuals in class when they ask me about the AMT is when you do your taxes or somebody else does your taxes, make sure that you run the AMT calculation. How is that done? Through IRS Form 6251. And I think most software now, like TurboTax, individuals prepare their own taxes, this is done automatically. The AMT calculation is done automatically on IRS Form 6251.
Yeah, for those of you preparing your own returns by hand, buy TurboTax. Do yourself
a favor. It's well worth the investment. It does not cost an arm and a leg. It'll give you peace of mind.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a subject that I think most people are somewhat conversant on, IRAs. IRA stands for Individual Retirement Arrangement. Many of us say an individual retirement account, kind of like potato, patata. It's an IRA. And you can put money into an IRA, provided that you have earned income, and we'll leave Ross out of this for a second. A traditional IRA, assuming that you have earned income and you're under 70 and a half. But what's significant about, gee, 2010 has passed. Can I still put money into my IRA for 2010, even though we're in 2011?
The answer is yes, Bob, because the deadline for funding one's prior tax IRA contribution, in this case the year 2010, is April 15th. That's the deadline. Even if you extend your file for an extension until October 15th, you have until April 15th to contribute to your IRA for the previous year. In this case, for the year 2010, the filing deadline is actually April 18th. We didn't mention this earlier.
But How does that work?
This year, April 15th turns out to be a Friday, April 15th, 2011. So you would think, well, that's still a business day. Why was the filing deadline extended to April 18th? Well, the next day, April 16th, is a Saturday. The filing deadline is never on a weekend. So April 15th, it turns out to be Emancipation Day in the District of Columbia, and the IRS has agreed that any holiday that falls in the District of Columbia, such as Emancipation Day, would result in it being a federal holiday in terms of IRS deadlines. So the deadline was extended to the next business day, which is Monday, April 18th. And that will be the deadline for contributing for 2010 IRAs.
Okay.
You have until midnight on April 18th, 2011, to make your 2010 IRA contribution.
I get this in class, and I'm sure you do as well. Somebody may or may not be able to fully maximize their thrift, but they feel that they cannot put money into an IRA, whether they fully fund their thrift or not. Is that true?
That's correct. There's only one requirement to put money into some type of IRA. You or your spouse, if you're married, has to have earned income. One of you. Now, what is earned income? A salary. You're getting paid. or if you're self-employed. You could be a self-employed person. So if there's anybody out there who is a federal employee, the mere fact that you worked during 2010 allows you and your spouse to contribute to some type of IRA. If somebody, let's say, is retired from federal service or for a private company, but their spouse is working, that allows the retiree to contribute to an IRA for 2010. Again, I think you mentioned this, Bob, but when we're talking about traditional IRAs, because there are two types of IRAs, traditional IRAs and Roth IRAs. When it comes to a traditional IRA, you cannot contribute to one if you're over 70 and a half, age 70 and a half, even if you're working. You're not allowed to put money into traditional.
Okay, so let's earned income again, salary, or maybe part-time work as a wage, small business profit if somebody's retired and had a... And the fourth one doesn't sound like earned income, but it is. It's alimony income. So there's really four types, and we can contribute up to, like you say, age 70 and a half, whether we fully funded the thrift or not. And if we happen to not be working, but our spouse is, we can piggyback on that. And we have up until what date again?
April 5th? This year, April 18th.
Okay.
I got to mention, though, that if you do contribute to your IRA for 2010, now we're into January 2011, it would be a good idea to mention to your IRA custodian you're making a contribution for 2010. Because most IRA custodians will assume, well, here it is 2011, your contribution's for 2011. So it would probably be a good idea to make sure that your IRA custodian is aware of the fact that you're contributing for 2010.
Okay, now, for those listening that do put money into their IRA but cannot tax deduct it because they're in this adjusted gross income thing is above a certain level, and let's leave that out because there's 12 different ways to talk about that. So let's say that you can't for whatever reason, and you still put money into your traditional IRA, make sure you file, what's that, Form 8606, to tell the IRS that money inside of that IRA didn't get a tax deduction going in, so it should not be taxed when the money comes back out.
That's correct. Anybody can contribute to what is called a non-deductible traditional IRA. When it comes to a deductible traditional IRA, there are AGI limitations, and these would be the limitations for 2010, and most people would probably know if they're going to be eligible to do a deductible traditional IRA because at the time they file their taxes, they know what their AGI is. That being said, though, that if one knows that they're not eligible for a traditional deductible IRA, they can always contribute to a non-deductible traditional IRA, no matter what their income is, as long as they have earned income, but to make sure that the IRS knows that the money that was used to fund the IRA was after-tax dollars, you have to file IRS Form 8606.
Okay, and this is extremely important, and we'll take just one more issue because we're running a little short of time. This will take a few minutes, a Roth IRA, because you may, underline the word may, be able to transfer money out of your traditional IRA total into a Roth IRA tax-free. That's a subject maybe for another day, and actually the other day was October 11th, 2010. Tammy Flanagan and I spent the entire hour, if you will, on how to do things like that. But let's take a look at Roth IRAs. I mean, a traditional IRA, long story short, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going to put X dollars in depending on my age, 5,000 or 6,000 if I'm not 50 or if I'm 50 or over. And I've deferred the income on that until I eventually take it out. As compared to a Roth IRA, same rules, same dollar maximum, same investment choices. They are mirror images of one another with one a huge exception. And what's that?
The exception is that everything coming out of a Roth IRA is tax-free. It doesn't even show up on your tax return. That, to me, is the best gift that Congress ever gave us.
All right. And, of course, anything good, as Ed clearly pointed out at the beginning of the show, generally has an income restriction.
And there are AGI limitations on contributing to Roth IRAs. I want to use the word contributing. Please emphasize on contributing. And again, one knows what the limit, what their AGI is for 2010. If they know what it is, they'll find that that'll determine if they're eligible to contribute to a Roth IRA for 2010.
Okay, and that varies. There's three different ways to look at it: married, filing, joint, qualifying widow, widower, is in one category, single or head of household is in another category, and married filing separately is in another category as far as income goes to be able to do the Roth.
And the IRS on their website and their publications, IRS in particular, IRS Publication 590, Individual Retirement Arrangements, will state what those limitations are for 2010.
Okay.
But there's another way we can get a Roth IRA.
Okay. Now, we've laid both out, but if we remember back with the traditional IRA, there is no income restriction. You have to have the earned income. But if you had $8 gazillion worth of earned income, you could still put money into a traditional. You couldn't deduct it.
Non-deductible.
Right. Non-deductible.
Right.
But then the end game would be able to move it into a
Roth IRA.
Now, this is tricky, right? Because now we remember we filed this Form 8606 with the feds to tell them that we did not deduct it. But that IRA population, IRS really isn't real concerned whether it's an IRA A, B, C, or D. They just don't care. What's the total value of all your IRAs at the end of the year? They call this the aggregation rule because they just add them all together. And they go, well, that's nice that you didn't deduct some, but we're going to tax you on some ratio. Isn't that right, Ed?
That's correct. It's very tricky. And this is mentioned, I wrote an article for the NITP website. We can mention that website where I wrote an article talking about the do's and don'ts of converting a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA on the website www.nitpinc.com. I wrote an article, I believe it was back last July, and one can retrieve that article, just go or download the article, and in which I talk about this ratio business. It's not an all or nothing proposition. You have to be very careful when you convert a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA to make sure you don't get caught in this so-called tax trap.
And there's an escape valve to move the taxable portion into the thrift. Now that gets into finance 810 and the like, and certainly can't be done in 2 minutes. But Ed, I'm sure that's on your Fed soup.
It's on Fed soup. And again, employees, individuals can send me as many questions as you want about that. And it's a very tricky thing. I would not do it until you're absolutely certain you got all the I's dotted and the T's crossed.
And it's also on our website on a prior show, the October 11th show. But in that, both verbally and the PDF file that we have on the show says, be careful. Don't do this on your own. Seek professional guidance. Wouldn't you say? Yeah,
absolutely.
Not to be self-serving, but why get caught in a tax trap if you don't have to?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so I think we've covered the waterfront. As they say, we have about a little over a minute here to go. Ed, kind of comments on getting ready for tax season to the listening audience, as well as what you might tell your own clients.
Get organized, get organized, get organized. That's the bottom line. And just make sure that you have everything in place so that when you file your taxes or someone else does, everything is there. The key here is being knowledgeable in every particular area that you may think that affects your taxes. Read up about it. But again, get organized. That's the bottom line. And as we mentioned earlier in the show, employees, take full advantage of your 2% tax cut, not for 2010 income taxes, but for 2011. We have to start thinking about 2011 taxes.
Yeah. And although I am a tax preparer, like Ed, I never get mad at people asking me questions. Now, I might get mad if they, not mad, I never get mad, but I might get a little disenchanted if somebody asks, can I deduct dog food? No, you can't do that. But they might say, well, how can I lower my taxes next year? And it leads to another discussion. So challenge your preparer. Yeah, if you do that, look at your diagnostics. If you use that thing called TurboTax, and the like. I think we're running real short of time here. So thanks for listening, and please tune us in next week. And I never remember who the guest is next week, but anyway, it'll be as charming as Ed. Great to have you, Ed.
Thanks so much for having me on, Bob.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in.